The other day, we explored a little bit of this topic of delusion. And didn't quite finish. So that's the topic for today. These more fundamental or human distortions, human ways that we mistake, make misperceptions, misinterpretations about experience. So these distortions, these forms of delusion are really the deepest, most fundamental mistakes that our mind makes, and they are common to all of us. We are not alone in having these misperceptions. But they are fairly insidious, deeply embedded in the way we see experience, interpret experience. And they are the basic reason why we suffer. And these three are, we tend to take what is impermanent to be permanent. We tend to take what is unreliable as a source of happiness to be a reliable source of happiness. And we tend to take what is not self to be self. These misperceptions are some of the basic things that block wisdom, get in the way of the cultivation, the development of wisdom. And their flip side, the recognition of experience as impermanent, unreliable, not self, is some of the deep wisdom that frees the mind from clinging. This kind of delusion is not the kind of delusion where we're not aware. We are aware, or can be aware, let's say we can be aware, but aware through a distorted filter. Sayadaw has a great phrase for this. He says, delusion doesn't mask the object. It masks the nature of the object. It masks the true nature of the object. I'm a fan of Shakespeare, and I think he was an amazing perceptive viewer of human nature. One of the plays he wrote, one of my favorites, The Tempest, is, if you're not familiar with it, it's basically the story of a magician who lives on an enchanted island, who enchants the island and who causes a tempest and a shipwreck to come upon the shore so she can effect some changes in the course of the lives of those people on the ship and on the island. And so in this shipwreck, some of the people on the who come ashore are very easily enchanted by this island. And others seem to be more able to see that things are a little odd here. There's one place where one of the people, there's three people kind of walking together around this island, and one of them is exclaiming how amazingly beautiful and green and verdant it is. And basically, the other two seeing it. And actually, as I reflect on this, it's like, maybe it's not so clear who's seeing it properly. But these two are seeing that it's basically an island of rock. It's green rock, but it's rock. And so these two are sitting there kind of in amazement at this other one who is exclaiming about how green, how verdant, how lovely. And they say to each other, "He misses not much." And the other one says, "No, he doth but mistake the truth totally." That's the nature of this kind of delusion. We don't miss things, but we mistake the truth of what's actually happening. So, to reflect on each of these a little bit, tending to see what is impermanent as permanent. Some of this is kind of human delusion, partly because of the way our perceptual processes work. That some of the change that is happening in experience is happening so rapidly that the rapidity of that change masks the change. Like our perceptual processes stabilize the world so that it makes it easier to navigate the world. So, in sight, for instance, as we turn our heads and look around the room, when I'm not that present, it looks very smooth when I turn my head and look around the room. Well, when I'm not that kind of clearly aware of the seeing process, it's like it doesn't look like you're all jumping in around the room. But there are times when, with a little more awareness of seeing, there's a real sense of there's not much stability in how that sight plays out. The stability of that seeing is a product of the mind kind of smoothing out the edges. In hearing, we can start to recognize, and the bell is a great place to play with this. It's like, it's not just that the bell is either ringing or not. Especially as the tone gets a little quieter, there's times when we might just hear it kind of end. But if we're really listening, there's a place in there where it gets the wave form of the wave of the sound, it gets stronger and it gets weaker, and sometimes it disappears from sound and then reappears and disappears and reappears as it weakens in sound. But we interpret it as either being there or not. And so these are just kind of examples of how our perceptual processes can mistake or just mask over the nature of the changing experience. And also, in this same terrain, I think some of what those examples I just described can also be understood through the way concept plays into masking change. So we tend to mediate our experience tends to be mediated through concepts. We hear a bird, for instance, and we think we're hearing a bird. We're hearing pitch and tone. And then the concept of bird gets applied to that. But we hear it through that lens or that filter of that concept. And so, you know, as a kind of an example of this, you know, our bodies, we often experience our bodies through the concept of the body, not through the actuality of the experience of body. And so right now, put your attention into your hand. Feel into the sensations in the hand. So just letting the attention rest in that basic area. There may be, if you just touch into the sensations, you know, vibration, maybe tingling, pulsing, really contacting the sensation that we call hand. There's not much stability there. There's a lot of change, and sensations don't stay stable for very long. And now, think about your hand and what it's used for, picking things up, touching things. You know, think, use the concept of hand. Some of you could open your eyes and look at your hand and think about it as a hand. That relating to it through concept, do you notice a difference? When I do that, I've done this so many times, and still every time I do it, while I can still kind of feel those sensations, they really recede. That quality, the quality of the dynamic changing nature of the sensations recede as I contemplate it as a hand and the things that hands do. And so this is, you know, the concept of our bodies, the concept that we relate to, tends to mask this phenomenon of impermanence. So these are natural functions of our mind. Concepts are really useful. We don't want to do away with concepts. It becomes quite exhausting to live a life if you have to figure out everything. Again, concepts are like a shortcut for us. They help us to navigate the world. And they do tend to bring in views and beliefs. You know, so concepts can be both very useful, and when not seen as concepts, they can be a great source of how dukkha is created in the world. bringing in views and ideas about a thing. We reify the thing as a thing. We don't really know it's a concept, and we attribute all of our views and beliefs to be reality about that. So it just becomes truth. This is the way that thing is, and we're not really meeting it as a changing dynamic experience or being, or we're not meeting the actual changing experience. We're meeting our idea about the experience. Anais Nin has a great phrase. We don't see things as they are. We see things as we are. And this reflects that way we lay views on top of our experience. And so mindfulness can begin to unmask this, becoming aware of the way our minds tend to obscure this truth of impermanence. We can begin to get curious, what's actually happening here? Painful sensation is a great kind of demonstration of this. I think many of you have noticed this kind of thing where maybe we think about a pain as being a kind of a block of sensation, and the idea of the pain is way worse than the pain itself. The idea of the pain, what's going to happen because of that pain, just the proliferation, the mind just going kind of nuts around that. That's all very painful too. And so it tends to reify and create even more of a sense of a block, of a nothing that's changing, the idea that it's going to be there forever may make us miss that it's actually a pretty small little thing, or maybe it's a little bit painful and it surges in pain, but then it really weakens and maybe even vanishes sometimes. We don't notice that because we're so lost in the concept of the idea that it's going to go on for a long time. It's just one example of how this kind of works. But we can get curious, you know, what's actually happening here? There's a reaction. What is the mind reacting to? Maybe curious about what's the actual sensation? What is that? When we touch into the quality of pain, it's very dynamic. It rarely stays stable for even a split second. It jumps around, it sparks, it stops, it shifts, it changes. And our minds can see how the concept of pain has created this sense of stability. It is through the concepts that the mind stabilizes and creates this notion of permanence. And so the investigation or exploration into, well, what's actually happening, and what is the mind thinking? What is the mind believing? What is the idea, the view, the concept that's at play here? And so a curiosity we can explore with respect to seeing what is impermanent as permanent. When we are attributing a stability or a solidity to something, maybe that can be a kind of a little spark of interest. The mind is taking this to be solid or stable. Is it really? How is the mind attributing solidity to this? And so that question, again, the question is just meant to bring the mind right into the present moment, to be curious about it. What is actually being interpreted as stable here? Is it really stable? Is it solid? We can be surprised with this kind of investigation. So what appears solid? What are you taking to be permanent? And then hover with that. There will be times in hovering with that that the mind basically is holding on to that concept. Nope, that is permanent. That pain is going to be here forever. And then noticing that belief, that view. The Buddha had a reflection for us. He acknowledged that certain pains, while pain itself is always dynamically fluctuating, so has that impermanent quality in general, it may well be that some pains are going to be with us. That we have some kind of an injury or an illness, that it's not the impermanent nature of that pain, is not that it's going to go away someday in this life. And that is exactly the reflection the Buddha points to. He says, you can contemplate sensation or these painful experiences as impermanent. And potentially, yeah, you may have to contemplate it as this pain will end upon the death of the body. When the body ends, this pain will end. So even what seems to be, you know, forever permanent will end with the death of the body. The solidity of the apparent solidity of the planet, that will end when our star someday blows up into a red giant. There will be no more Earth. So on this vast scale, we can also contemplate this impermanence. And the Buddha encouraged us to notice these different levels of impermanence. At a very deep level, experientially, moment to moment, there is no stability of experience. There's constant change. And yet at the relative level, even at the relative level where it feels like there is stability, there is a reflection that, yeah, even at this level, even at the relative level, while it's not change at that particulate level, there is no stability, no permanence, even at the relative level. So this reflection, he encourages us to reflect on this as well as experience the impermanence in our direct experience. The second one, taking what is unreliable to be reliable. This is a strong habitual thing with our human, the way our human system is put together, you know, based really on a very natural, what the right word is, all life tends to orient towards moving towards what's pleasant and away from what's unpleasant. And we're no different. It's very deeply conditioned into us in the evolutionary development of our being, that we tend to want to move towards, gravitate towards pleasant and push away the unpleasant. And the kind of movement of our system, of our organism, the movement towards well-being and away from suffering, that movement that we've talked about is based in this, is based in this deeply evolutionary process of gravitating towards, like a single-celled creature will gravitate towards nourishment and food and away from noxious chemicals. And likewise, we tend to gravitate towards what moves us in the direction of well-being, except in our system, the way our being has evolved, there's many layers of processes, many kinds of processes in between that pleasant thing and the decision to move towards it. Views, ideas, beliefs, conditioning, what is worth moving towards, beliefs, ideas about what's worth moving towards, what's not worth moving towards, understanding about delayed gratification, all kinds of things come into play in between that kind of automatic movement. So we don't have that automatic movement. There's a lot of systems at work that are in play between the pleasant thing and the movement towards the pleasant thing. But very much we do learn in our lives that when we get something we want, when we get associated with something pleasant, there's a hit of a feeling of goodness. It feels like, yeah, that feels good. There's some happiness there. When we get something we want, there's happiness. And the Buddha acknowledged that this is a kind of happiness. That moment of getting association with what is loved, dissociation with what is not loved, those movements. He acknowledged, yes, there's a form of happiness that comes with that. And he pointed out that it is the least kind of happiness that it's available for us as human beings. But most of us think that kind of happiness, before we meet a practice like this, before we begin to taste some of the benefits of the mind that can settle and become stable and concentrated, before we taste some of the delight of understanding and letting go, we think that sense pleasure, that getting what I want, getting rid of what I don't want, that happiness is as good as it gets. That's the best kind of happiness that's out there. And so, of course, we gravitate towards that. Until we learn something different, that would be where we would go. That would be where we would find happiness. And yet that kind of happiness, it contains that hit of happiness. You get that moment of, oh yeah, that feels good. But it is, that moment is worth actually looking at a little bit, because the pleasure, the happiness that comes with that has at least two different sides to it. One of the sides is the pleasure with having the association, the connection with something pleasant. There is a kind of a happiness of that. The other side of the happiness that comes with getting something that we want is that for a moment, the wanting goes away. And that experience of the wanting releasing, that is most likely the greater share of the happiness. Because the experience of wanting itself is actually quite unpleasant. And so in the moment that we get something that we want, we not only get this association with something pleasant, but we get a release from that unpleasantness of the wanting. And the wanting, the delusion that's embedded in that wanting, tells the story that the only way that this wanting can be appeased or released is to have the thing that it wants. And so the wanting is embedded with that view. Now wanting, and this is a great kind of exploration to look at, is when there is some kind of wanting to maybe pick something that's not such a big deal, like, you know, getting seconds on strawberries or something. Just something that would be nice, but, you know, just give yourself an opportunity to watch the wanting, you know, seeing, you know, there were only four left in the bowl when I walked through the line, you know, kind of keeping an eye on the table. Anybody going back to that, you know, kind of track all of that, track it in your mind and notice the feeling of the wanting itself. Don't see if you can refrain from acting on that wanting in favor of witnessing the wanting. You will feel the dukkha of that wanting. And at some point, because fortunately, this too is an impermanent phenomenon, it won't last forever. At some point, that wanting will go away. Now, you may or may not get to see that. You may not get to see that vanishing of wanting. But at some point you can recognize, maybe you've kind of lost interest in the observing the strawberries and just kind of gone off in something else, and you've gotten up and wandered away, and, you know, you're in your room and suddenly realize, wow, yeah, that wanting is gone. Okay. How is it now that wanting is gone? Do you still want the strawberry? Is it a problem that you don't have the strawberry? So the power of watching this is essentially in the terrain of one of the instructions the Buddha offered around this. It's like what we take as a reliable kind of happiness, sense pleasure often. And sense pleasure includes that sense of control to not be associated with things that I don't like, associated with what I like, not with what I don't like. The Buddha encouraged us to, when we notice a kind of sense of happiness, it's like, yeah, this feels good. When we notice a kind of happiness that comes from getting something that we want, he encourages us to notice how far does that happiness last? And so sometimes we can actually follow through, and that's another way to explore this. Get the second strawberry and then be curious about, okay, you get that strawberry, it's really great while you're eating it. Maybe there's a little bit of a sense of, oh, this is, you know, the last strawberry, so I don't get another one, but there's some pleasantness there. And then, you know, how long does it last? How far does that gratification extend? That's the phrase the Buddha used. How far does that gratification extend? And then he also encouraged us to notice the danger within that gratification, which is when we follow through on a wanting, we are reinforcing that belief that getting that thing is the way happiness will come. And so we are essentially pondering that. That becomes the inclination of the mind as we follow through on these wantings. But really that exploration of looking at the wanting itself can be so powerful to begin to recognize, you know, in the moment when we want and we are bought into the wanting, usually the wanting is obscured because we are, in the next moment, we are imagining how good it's going to be to either have that thing or get rid of that thing. We're living in a constructed future just the next moments away. And so we're missing that the wanting itself is already suffering. And that wanting, again, the wanting is not going to tell you. If the wanting goes away, it's not going to be a problem. That wanting is so embedded in that belief, I need that thing. But from time to time, we can observe the wanting. See what happens when we don't follow through. Beginning to recognize that engine of wanting and not wanting is confusing the mind to believe that there is a reliable happiness to be found from following through on that wanting or that aversion. And then the third, tending to take what is not self to be self. Again, there's a kind of a view and the Buddha calls it identity view. This sense of self is it's a view. A view that I am something or someone or have certain qualities as a kind of a fixture. They're always there. Before I started practicing, I was pretty miserable. Lots of self-hatred, sense of I'll never be happy. And yet, there were times when I was happy. But what my mind did in those moments was something like, well, yeah, I'm happy now, but I know that what I really am is miserable. So essentially imputing a kind of solidity, a thingness, a stability to that miserable self was such an identity that when it wasn't there, I basically wasn't really able to take in that it wasn't there. This is a helpful practice for us sometimes. We all have kind of familiar or favorite identities, ones that come back, recur a lot. And notice, I mean, we can notice whether we are attributing or just assuming that they're kind of always there in the undercurrent, even when they're not active, you know. So we may have this sense of like, yeah, that's, I know that it's there. It's just, this is not, this happiness here, that's not me. I know that this miserable is me. And so a practice or an exploration can be really taking in or noticing when a particular sense of self or identity is not there. We can recognize, at times we can recognize that it really isn't there. I seemed to think with this miserableness that there was just this pool of miserableness that was there, and it was just like maybe quiet right now, but it was there. And the more I looked at and observed the dynamic as I did begin practicing, the dynamic around self-hatred, for instance, the more I began to see that that self-hatred, when it arose, was arising in the moment. It was being put together in the moment. It wasn't that that it was like picking up something that was already there and bringing it out fully formed. It was being created right in the moment based on views and some kind of a thought, probably, some kind of a belief and a thought, and, you know, hooking into this tendency, the habit of the mind, that inclination of the mind the Buddha talks about. What we frequently ponder becomes the inclination of the mind. But it is not an inclination, or as the Buddha calls it, underlying tendencies, are not a thing that's just like an entity waiting to appear. It's a condition that can be activated based on, or it's a tendency that can be activated based on conditions, views, beliefs, triggers. Starting to see these senses of identity, senses of self coming into being, and recognizing that when they're not there, they're actually not there. Although sometimes, you know, I it does happen that the recognition, oh, it's not there right now, it's like the mind will just pick it up and in that moment construct it. And almost to, as if to prove, yes, I really am here. But it is, if you're really kind of curious, it is just an arising in this moment. Suffering is created in this moment. The sense of self that's arising now is created now. It's not a stable, solid, pervading thing. And so this is the misunderstanding around the sense of self, is essentially we attribute to this process nature of experience, this tumbling on of conditionality, we attribute a thingness to it, an identity to it. It's kind of like, it's just processes at work. We are nature. We are a growing being that has life processes that function. Hunger creates this urge to eat. That creates processes that develop cells and the body grows. There's no need to attribute a me there that does it. It's just processes at work. Very like a tree growing. You know, a tree grows based on conditions. There's those redwood trees. You know, you've seen those little tiny cones. You know, these little tiny cones are what those redwood trees come from. And that cone falls. There's little tiny seeds in there, and conditions of water, of moisture, of sun, of the right place that that seed fell, not on the walking path, so it gets trampled down over and over. Conditions come into play that create the possibility of it turning into a tree. But even reflecting on this, it's like, when does it become a tree? You know, it starts as the seed, and then it grows, you know, it sprouts these roots, and a little sapling comes up. And is it a tree yet? Well, no, not really. When does it become a tree? It's just an evolution, a flow, a changing conditions. And we don't necessarily, I mean, there are, I think there are some that might attribute an entity of life, of some kind of being to that tree. But it will grow based on the conditions. It doesn't actually need, there's not like a process in there that says, oh, I think I'm going to sprout a branch out that way now. It happens because of conditions, because there's sun in that direction, or however it grows. Our own being is very similar. And because we have this self-reflective capacity of mind, we tend to look back at something that's happened and say, oh, well, I did that. This kind of the sense of self, this is something we can also be curious about, not only curiosity around the sense of self of when is it there, certain identities, you know, when are certain identities there, when are they not there, but I just lost the thought. It's gone. It was not self. Okay. So we can observe this sense of self, however it feels. Whenever it feels like an I or me, or there's a feeling of mine. The practice, a famous Zen saying, Dogen, to study the way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be awakened by all things. And so, you know, we don't try to get rid of a self. What we're exploring is understanding that this sense of self is just a misperception, a misinterpretation. So we study it. When there's that sense of me, what is that like? What is that sense of me like? What is that sense of I am like? And beginning to recognize it's not always the same. Sometimes we can see a particular identity. The other day I mentioned one for myself, you know, just really identified with being this analytical, intelligent person. I knew how questions were supposed to be asked in the meditation hall. And this other person was not doing it properly. And lots of suffering there. I could see there was a sense of self there, so I was, you know, noticing it, feeling the suffering of that kind of congealing around that identity. And just really feeling into this, doing walking meditation. And the truck drives up. And the analytical self just vanished. And it was replaced by this delighted 2-year-old. Wow, that is so cool. Bang, smash, brakes hissing. And it was so startling because I had been so interested in observing, and I think partly because I had attributed a little bit of solidity to that sense of self, that is me, that seeing it vanish was very powerful. Seeing it just like, yeah, there is no relationship between this experience of delighting in the truck and that experience of being an analytical person who knows she's right. They're just not connected. So sometimes that's what we see. We see a kind of transition between identities. Sometimes we don't notice these transitions. It's just seamless from one to another. But curiosity, exploration. What is it that you are taking to be self? How is it felt? Is it always there? Sometimes I think the experience of self is just a whole bunch of familiar contractions. Well, this is a set of contractions around being a daughter. This is a set of contractions around being a friend. This is the set of contractions around being a teacher. You know, any identification there. There's some familiar, it's like we get so familiar with it. It's like the mind and body lock into that. And it's like, oh yeah, I know that. And it's almost like it feels like it's like an old shoe or a glove. It's kind of comfortable. And so we don't really question it. Don't see it as a construction in the moment. So these distortions operate on different levels. The teaching that I'm exploring today is from a sutta called the Vipalasa Sutta in the Anguttara Nikaya. And he goes through these distortions, and he also points out that each of these distortions happens at three different levels. More light, not quite so sticky, down to very, very sticky. So each of these can be kind of a distortion at the level of perception. So the example here that's given in the suttas is, you know, how are we experiencing things through our senses? So we take things in and we interpret things to be a certain thing. And, you know, so like maybe we walk into a dimly lit room and there's a coil in the corner and the perception is it's a snake. So that the conditions there, the dim light, create some conditions that perhaps let us misinterpret or misperceive, so that sometimes there is just simply a misperception. And this kind of distortion can be fairly easily corrected with, well, let's say, adding some light to the situation. In this case, you know, turning the light switch on in the room. So the coiled rope, we see it's a coiled rope. And we don't tend to, at that point, say, but it's a snake. You know, we know it's a rope now. So that distortion is fairly easily released. Then the next level is said to be the distortion around thought. So the first level is just like the way our senses are perceiving something. And the second level, it kind of gets a little bit more in depth. It's like, yeah, we really think that's a snake. So in a way, this is like attributing a level of reality. So this is, I take this as being like, instead of just the perception, it's like the concept of snake is being held to, reified. It's like, yes, that is a snake. Maybe a little harder to notice that it's not a snake when the light goes on. And then the third level of distortion is where we harden it into a view or a belief. We believe it is a snake. And it gets very difficult to convince us otherwise. Can't shake that view. So, and these kind of loop back on each other too. So, you know, if we believe that's a snake, if the depth of it goes to the level of view, then we will tend to perceive it as snake the next time, So an example from my own experience that kind of can demonstrate these in a lived experience, in a real, I mean, that example of the coiled rope and the snake, that's the sutta way of describing these different levels. But in my own experience, at one point, I was practicing at Chwe Umin in Burma, and each evening around the same time, I heard a sound, a squealing sound. And I was usually meditating in my room at that time of the day, you know, dusk time of the day. And hearing that squealing sound repetitively, I think the first few times it was just squealing, squealing. And then hearing it repetitively, the mind started to go, well, what is that? You know, what is that squealing? And it landed on, it perceived it. So this is that first level. It perceived it as a pig. So the sound, I had heard squealing before. This is like the closest pattern matching my mind did. So that was the perception. There's a pig out there somewhere. And I lived pretty close to the edge of the monastery, and there was a lot of activity on the other side of the monastery wall and noise and, you know, things kind of filtering over the monastery wall. And so my mind decided that this pig squealing each night was not the same pig each night, but a different pig being slaughtered by the butcher. So that became, you know, I knew that that was a thought. So it was a thought. I knew it was a thought. And I knew, I didn't know that that was really happening, but that was arising, this idea, and so it shaped the experience. There was a feeling of compassion for the pig. There was a sadness about the pain that it might be feeling. The sound sounded kind of distressed to me. So that, you know, that was all going on, even though I knew. So I could see that the thought that it was the pig was being slaughtered was a thought. I knew that that might not be true. So there was that, at least that level of seeing something about this perception happening. I could tell. Yeah, I don't really know that that's happening. One night, a few nights later, I was out doing walking meditation at that time. And there were these things flying through the air, and they were like coming really close to me and flashing through the air, and they were squealing. They were bats squealing. And in that moment, instantly I realized that there wasn't a pig being slaughtered. And the whole, of course, the whole like thought really vanished, that there's no compassion needed. What I found interesting on reflection of that experience was I had seen that the thought that that it was a pig being slaughtered was a view. What I had not seen, I had no concept of possibly, was that it was not a pig. I did not see that. That was believed. That was a view. The perceptual process had made a mistake. That perceptual process, if the next day, you know, if you know, the correcting of that perceptual process came when I saw the bat squealing, so it did pop that quickly when I saw that. But in that whole few days, there was no inkling in the mind at all that the idea that it was a pig was a view. It was truth. And that is this third level, really this strong level of delusion, where we believe our perceptions, we believe what's happening to be, we believe our perspective on it to be what is happening. And this is really a very powerful deluding force in the mind, the way we take our perceptions to be reality. All we are experiencing is what our minds are putting together. We can't actually know what is out there. We can't know, the reality of what's out there. And we tend to forget that what we are experiencing is a construction of our minds. And we take that experience to be what is happening, the reality of what's happening, as opposed to this construction in the mind. Our minds construct our experience, and it's very easy for mistakes to happen, for views to enter in, to skew that experience. And we so rarely recognize or take in that the only thing that we know is what is created by our own minds. And this is a big part of what the Buddha wanted us to see. And what we cling to, what we cling to is created by our minds. We don't really cling to what's actually out there. We cling to an idea. So the suffering, the clinging that creates the experience of suffering, we begin to see that that's created by the mind. You know, that it is kind of an optional extra thing that we're holding on, wanting something to stay. It's a little harder to see that the thing we're clinging to is also constructed by our minds. It's not anything that really exists anywhere. It's a thought, an idea, a concept. Now check it out for yourself. What are you actually clinging to? So this thread of thinking about these distortions, the flip side of it is the what's usually called the three characteristics. All conditioned phenomena, this famous kind of saying, all conditioned phenomena are impermanent, all conditioned phenomena are unreliable, all phenomena are not self. This is, seeing this is some of the wisdom that frees the mind. And that's going to be kind of the thread that we wander on for the next few days. So let's just sit for a moment.